Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 89. It's the story of an intensely studied but not so well-known element of the forensic review related to the damage to the president's head and what it meant for determining just where the shots came from that day. It's the story of the Harper fragment. But let's back up for a moment and remember just how terrifically macabre the entire scene was at the moment that the president was shot. It truly was one of the most horrific scenes in our history, and within it was a moment caught on the Zapruder film that is emblematic of the trauma. A moment that is hard to erase from one's mind once you've seen it. It involves those few seconds within the Zapruder film that occurred just after the shots hit the president, and Clint Hill began to race to the limousine. And just when Jacqueline Kennedy herself crawled up and backwards onto the trunk of the presidential limousine, attempting to retrieve the president's brain, because it had been scattered into pieces in that now sacred part of Dealey Plaza. I can't imagine the trauma of that moment, but crawling up on that trunk to find her, well, hopeless act of mercy and courage in the face of such evil. She crawled up on the back of that limousine top, chasing a portion of the president's head, as if she could put her husband back together again. There was plenty more of the president's skull that was so violently dislodged as a result of such a violent shooting. Plenty enough that even after Jacqueline Kennedy clutched a piece of it that had traversed only as far as the back of the limousine, well, there were still four more fragments that would be retrieved and play a part in the forensic review, or the subsequent analysis of the forensics. The piece of the skull that Jacqueline Kennedy would hold on to for the remainder of the ride to Parkland was the biggest of all. It would eventually be named the Delta Fragment. Its presence was clearly discernible on the Zapruder tape as Mrs. Kennedy reached out for it and Clint Hill nudged it back into her hand as it skidded backward and as he was lunging forward onto the limousine. The shot was so violent and so explosive that it was like detonating a bomb inside the president's head. You heard in previous episodes that he suffered multiple fractures, and during the x-ray procedures, as Gerald Custer handled his head, the fractures felt like a hard-boiled egg that had been rolled in your hand. The fractures were abundant and almost everywhere. But these bone fragments were a result of the physics that are necessary when such a powerful shot makes its way inside the head. The wave of energy is absorbed and transferred, and its concentration eventually bursts a hole and ejects the fragments. This violent process happens so quickly and with such force that some theories surmise that these fragments can pierce the thin membrane that surrounds the skull and the skin and the scalp too, leaving in some cases the skin of the scalp intact, with only a tear from the exit. As a layperson, that is hard to believe, but apparently that is so, and apparently that is at least a part of the explanation as to why part of the skull and brain are missing, and yet the related parts of the skin and scalp appear to be somewhat left intact. More on that later. So this violent energy of the shot meant that more than one fragment would eject from the president's body that day. There were two other smaller fragments that hurled off into the front area of the limousine. They were retrieved by the Secret Service as the car was inspected and flown to Bethesda late on the night of the assassination. In addition to those two fragments that were used in the actual autopsy proceeding on Friday night, and then on Saturday, there were two other fragments still to be found right there in Dealey Plaza. And the story of the largest of those two fragments is the story that you'll hear today, the piece of the president's skull bone that has now come to be known as the Harper fragment. In addition to the Harper fragment, there was a second fragment retrieved in Dealey Plaza, but we won't touch upon that until we finish with the Harper fragment first. The Harper fragment is one of the most studied elements of the forensic examination of the president's head wounds. There are reams of information about it, and some of it very highly technical, and some just highly theoretical. To this day, there are no definitive answers to the most basic question surrounding the fragment itself, and that is, what part of the brain did this fragment actually come from? And why is the answer to that question so important? Well, answering that question could put to bed the basic question of whether there was a gaping hole in the occipital region of the back of the president's head, or not. And remember our simple truth and axiom about the direction from which the shots came from. If there was a hole, a blowout hole in the occipital region, well, experts tell us that it must have been caused by a shot coming from somewhere other than the rear and above, and thus a second shooter involved. So, in some ways, with all of the bungled elements of the autopsy and all the suspicion around missing, altered, or even faked autopsy evidence, here was a piece of forensic autopsy evidence that might tell the story all by its lonesome. A Rosetta Stone, so to speak, when reconstructing the skull parts and the conclusions of the autopsy itself. And this story of this fragment is, in and of itself, well, seemingly written like it was full of elements from a Dan Brown novel, just like so many other parts of the story of the JFK assassination. You know, as I keep saying to you, you really can't make this stuff up. As you know, I like to joke around and say sometimes that I'm not a lawyer, but I sometimes play one on TV. Well, I'm not a forensic pathologist either, but sometimes I do try to play one on this podcast. Okay, in all seriousness though, I can't do justice to all of the technical analysis that's been done on the Harper fragment, but I can make an attempt to bring to life the basic story of the fragment and the way it ultimately fit into the investigation and some of the work that was done afterward to better understand whether this piece of skull bone was really the Rosetta Stone that would determine the direction of one or more of the shots or not. And that is the objective of these episodes on the Harper fragment. But this is one of the most studied pieces of evidence by assassination researchers and certainly doctors and other scientists. So we would be remiss if we didn't mention some of those expert views of what the Harper fragment really means to the conclusions about a shooter conspiracy. So we'll do that too as we wander through the story of the Harper fragment. So, without further ado, let's listen to episode 89 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. Dealey Plaza was anything but the modern crime scene that you and I are used to. You know, even after any serious crime in the times that we now live in today, there would be a cordoning off of the area. You know, yellow tape encircling where the crime scene occurred, and there wouldn't be hundreds of people tromping all through the area and surely compromising the evidence, no matter what good intentions they might have had. Now, we have to remember it was 1963 and there was no yellow tape and, quite frankly, on Saturday, November 23rd, the world's emotions surrounding the event itself were still running incredibly high. And Dealey Plaza was full of curious onlookers who wanted to see and experience the actual place where this horrific event occurred. And of course, certainly there were those that were in Dealey Plaza just trying to pay some level of respect to the fallen president and his family. And still others were trying to gain real knowledge about what actually did happen and make sense of it all. And so it was around 5:30 p.m. on that Saturday, November 23rd, 1963, when William Allen Harper, who was a college student there in Dallas, actually a pre-med student, made his way to the plaza. He was in the middle of taking photographs, and he found a small object which appeared to be a bone fragment. What could it be? Well, young Bill Harper picked up the fragment and took it to his uncle, Dr. Jack Harper, who worked at Methodist Hospital there in Dallas. After reviewing the bone fragment, Dr. Jack Harper, on Monday, November 25th, would call the FBI and speak with FBI agent James Anderton. So it's important to pause here and remind the listener that the authorities were not made aware of this very large fragment of human skull until Monday after the weekend's events had occurred related to the president's autopsy, but perhaps known about before at least some of the supplemental forensic work took place on the president's brain. And the existence of this fragment was certainly known about before the supplemental review was fully completed and documented. David Lifton, in his celebrated book, Best Evidence, gives a good account of what took place behind the scenes related to the Harper fragment, although this information wasn't revealed until the FBI released many documents in 1978. When FBI agent Anderton notified the Secret Service of the existence of this fragment, he was immediately instructed by Robert Bauck that the bone fragment should be sent to the White House, and I quote, "no publicity whatsoever," end quote. Robert Bauck was the then chief of the Protected Research Section of the Secret Service in Washington. Anderton wrote that comment in a November 25, 1963 field office memo. Meanwhile, FBI Assistant Director Alan Belmont had a different idea on how the bone fragment should be handled. Belmont called the Dallas FBI office and instructed that the bone fragment instead be sent directly to the FBI lab in Washington. FBI lab sheets indicate that when the bone reached Washington, the lab x-rayed the fragment and found no metal, but did find traces of human blood, a notation that was made in the FBI records at the time. No report to be made. In Dallas, Agent Anderton wrote that Dr. Berkeley had passed the word through the Secret Service that the fragment should be delivered to the White House so that, in the event this bone fragment came from President Kennedy's head, it can be included in the autopsy reports. But the bone was not given to the autopsy doctors, nor was any mention of it made in the autopsy, although another aspect of the autopsy was still to be done, that is, the brain. By then, the brain had been fixed in formaldehyde. Refer back to our earlier episodes on the timing of the supplemental brain exam. The matter might have ended right there had it not been for facts known to the FBI. In Dallas, Dr. Jack Harper had Dr. A.B. Cairns, who was the chief pathologist at Methodist Hospital there in Dallas. While each of them examined the specimen, and both men concluded that it was probably part of the occipital bone. Next, the fragment was shown to a third Dallas physician, Dr. Gerhard Noteboom, who reaffirmed that he too believed it was part of the occipital bone. Before the fragment was turned over to the authorities, it was photographed by Wayne Bulatier, who was the chief medical photographer at Methodist Hospital. It is believed that he made 12 photographs of the fragment before it was returned to the FBI. In June 1964, Attorney General Robert Kennedy received a letter from a woman in Hayward, California, who wrote that she hoped the Attorney General would someday run for president. She added almost in passing that in Dallas, she had seen snapshots taken at a hospital of pieces of his brother's head. Robert Kennedy forwarded the letter to the Warren Commission, and it made its way to Chief Counsel Lee Rankin. Rankin's second-in-command on the staff was Howard Willens, and Willens immediately requested an FBI investigation. Now, the FBI learned for the first time that pictures of the bone had been taken in Dallas. Moreover, the Dr. Cairn had an opinion about the anatomic origin of this bone fragment. The FBI report of a formal interview with Dr. Cairn in July 1964 states the following. Dr. Cairn advised that he and Dr. Harper examine the bone, and that Dr. Cairn stated that the one specimen looked like it came from the occipital region of the skull. He said he evaluated it purely from its gross appearance. David Lifton's initial reaction to this information in 1972 was simple and straightforward. If this piece of the skull had come from the occipital region, then there would be no more debate as to whether it was a gaping hole within that part of the skull. And more importantly, it might also signify that certain autopsy photographs and certain autopsy x-rays were clearly fakes as well. The bone itself is trapezoidal in shape, and when you apply a ruler to the existing photographs, it measures approximately 7 by 5.5 centimeters. Paul Eaton, a JFK assassination researcher, participated in a talk show in Palm Springs, California on November 22, 1992, the 29th anniversary of the assassination. And during that talk show, he interviewed Dr. Gerhard Noteboom on the program. Dr. Noteboom reaffirmed the narrative that all three pathologists at Methodist Hospital examined the Harper fragment and thought it was occipital bone. Dr. Noteboom also noted that there were lead fragments on the Harper fragment. So where did the bone fragment go from here? Surely the fragment was turned over to the pathologists, Humes and Boswell, right? Shouldn't the two men in charge of the president's autopsy take possession of this fragment and perform an examination of it? Shouldn't such a fragment be an integral part of solving the puzzle, no matter what such examination indicated? Well, neither Humes nor Boswell, during the course of the one and only autopsy, ever saw the fragment. And they did not have it during their post-autopsy supplemental examination of the brain. Why not? Was it prima facie evidence that Dr. Berkeley did not want to be further reviewed? Was it due to the Kennedy family wishes that enough was enough? What could possibly justify holding that fragment and refraining from further analysis at that very moment? Moreover, the Harper fragment was never seen again. Where did it go? And again, why was it being hidden? 6 decades later, we do not know the answer to that. And honestly, the identification of this bone fragment and the determination of what specific spot it emanated from is still a matter of great debate today. Anyone with a medical background and a cover-up in mind would realize that the answer to this question was so complex that releasing it to the autopsy doctors or to the general public was unlikely to produce a definitive answer. It's ironic that the decision to conceal it only added to the suspicion years later that some sort of a medical conspiracy had occurred that day at Bethesda. What is even more suspicious is that the Harper fragment has never been seen since. It just went missing as soon as it got into the hands of Dr. Berkeley and then passed to the FBI. Strange, you say? Well, what was preserved was some very good photographs, and while photographs are no substitute for being close up or holding that fragment in your own hands, those photos are as good as it's ever going to get at this point. Oh, wait a minute. And wouldn't you know it, even the Zapruder film plays into it here. You see, not only can you see in clarity the Delta fragment and the famous story around it that we just told, but the ejection of both the Harper fragment and the Weitzman fragment were also captured by Zapruder's masterful camera work. The Harper fragment ejection can also be seen in the next film, but it's not as clear as what can be seen in the Zapruder film. The Zapruder film, right at around frame Z312 or 313, visualizes what some experts, including David Mantic, agree is the path taken by the Harper fragment as it ejected out of the president's brain and then traveled like a soccer ball, finally landing on the south side of the plaza about 25 feet to the president's left, which is south and slightly forward of the car. Remember that term, slightly forward of the car. There it was violently ejected at first, but lying now gently in the grass. Billy Harper, the young man for which the fragment was named, would later revisit the assassination site and reconfirm the approximate spot where he retrieved the fragment. That's an important point to know because there was plenty of controversy around the exact landing spot of that fragment and what it meant to the determination of where that fragment came from. It should be noted that Harper's identification of the spot where he retrieved the fragment is entirely consistent with the trajectory and travel of the fragment as shown in the Zapruder film. How could the fragment have been ejected forward and to the left when it was a piece of bone coming from the right rear? A good question to ask, don't you think? And that is one of the very important questions to ask if you believe this bone was a piece of occipital bone. By the way, Before we answer that one, the Weitzman fragment was found on the south side of the curb on Elm Street, which was closer to the limousine and also farther to the rear, and it can also be seen on the Zapruder film. The Weitzman fragment is smaller than the Harper fragment, and it was identified shortly after the assassination and was flown to Washington and used in the autopsy proceedings that night. The actions taken first by Dr. Berkley and then the steps taken by the FBI virtually assured that this critical piece of evidence would not be critically reviewed by the Warren Commission. Yes, it was mentioned in a few FBI reports, but there was nothing about this fragment that would support the theory of the lone gunman. So, in the FBI's eyes, and the Warren Commission's eyes, this was perhaps just another piece of evidence where they would just let sleeping dogs lie. Little was known about the Harper fragment for years, until the 1967 study of the assassination and the Warren Commission report by CBS. CBS convened the iTech Corporation, which, at the time, had some notoriety as a high-tech company that, ironically, had ties to the CIA, including the manufacturer of certain high-end technologies contained in the U-2 spy plane. iTech was tasked in various engagements with various technical reviews related to both the photographic and video materials associated with the assassination, mostly with very specific testing objectives. As CBS began to put together their news special, they reconvened iTech to review the Zapruder film and, more specifically, to review the frames which showed actual ejection of brain matter. This particular review was for the purposes of establishing the direction of the spray of the brain matter as part of the process to forensically identify the direction from which the shots were taken. In other words, to verify or wreak havoc on the lone gunman theory. As I said, the study was part of a nationally televised special on the assassination, and it certainly did bring light to the Harper fragment. Like so much in the study of the assassination, the Harper fragment would again take a low profile for the next few years. But fast forward to the work being done in the late 1970s by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and there you can find the next attempt to explore more deeply where the Harper fragment actually came from. Unfortunately, the House Select Committee on Assassinations conducted a process that seemingly resulted in no real conclusions regarding the origin of this skull fragment. In fact, one could argue that all they did was to bring more confusion and uncertainty around where this bone fragment should be placed in the reconstruction. The HSCA medical panel still had no exhibit to examine. That is, no actual Harper bone fragment to look at. So the next best thing would be to review the photographs. And that is what they did. Keep in mind that the HSCA, at least in the early going, was reasonably well-funded and deployed a fair number of investigators and outside experts to examine materials and do further investigation beyond what the FBI and the Warren Commission had done in 1964. As you know, Dr. Michael Bodden was the head of the HSCA medical panel. With good intentions, they brought in an anthropologist, J. Lawrence Angel, who was a PhD on loan from his curator position at the Smithsonian Institute. Dr. Angel, whose sole purpose was to review the fragment without bias, without prior knowledge or conclusions made by the Dallas doctors at Methodist Hospital, or observations already made by the HSCA panel itself, he was there to independently determine whether the bone was from the occipital area of the skull or whether it was from the parietal area or some other area, and continue to keep in mind that the possibility of these two different areas also meant the possibility of two different conclusions on the direction from which the shots came. The exchange between Dr. Angel and the HSCA medical panel was interesting. I'll share some of the thoughts on this exchange as they were captured in David Lifton's best evidence and excerpted from some of the testimony that was taken that day. Here we go. Dr. J. Lawrence Angel, curator of physical anthropology at the Smithsonian, arrived at the meeting of the HSCA medical panel. Dr. Charles Petty, the chief medical examiner of Dallas, Texas, and a member of the panel, said he would like very much to have Angel's expertise in identifying this particular fragment and determining what part of the head it came from. Dr. Angel's response was, well, it's clearly parietal bone. Side left or right, it's not so easy. As evidence for this assertion, Dr. Angel said, you can see one or two or three markings for meningeal vessels on the inner surface. Based on that, he said the bone could fit into the huge hole, oh, around here. Around where? Asked Dr. Petty. Well, Dr. Angel tried to describe the location, and he qualified his opinion at first, saying, I could see marks of sagittal suture here, but I don't think that's it. And then Dr. Angel discovered that what he had been calling a suture line wasn't a suture line at all. Suture lines go completely through the bone. But Dr. Angel couldn't find a corresponding line on the photograph of the interior surface of the Harper fragment. Well, excuse me, he would say, it doesn't seem to show in the inside. I'm puzzled, he would say. Dr. Angel turned to the others. Are you sure that's suture edge there? They were of little help. Dr. Boswell replied, we're not sure. We ask for your advice. Then Dr. Davis, also present and on the medical panel, said, that's why you're here, sir. Dr. Angel then explained why his original idea was wrong. He said, I thought these, referring to the grooves visible on the interior surface, I thought these were intermediate posterior branches of middle meningeal going up the side of the parietal. Here he would add, I would have looked here for a trace of lambdoid suture. The lambdoid suture is an inverted V-shaped suture that marks the border of the occipital bone at the back of the head, the border with the left and the right parietal bones. If the Harper bone had contained lambdoid suture, it would be part occipital and part parietal, depending upon where the suture line was. Then Dr. Angel remarked, but of course, I don't know what damage the skull showed and whether this has to be, but I'm not supposed to know this. That was the essence of the matter. Dr. Angel's identification should have been based on anthropological evidence alone, not a knowledge of where the bone was supposed to fit. The committee proceeded on a different basis from that point on. After that, Dr. Biden said, no, Dr. Angel, feel free to discuss this with Dr. Humes, who did the autopsy. He'd be delighted to engage with you. Well, Angel asked if there was a defect on the right that this would fit into, and Humes then replied, as if rewarding a good student bright enough to ask the proper question, Dr. Angel, yes. Well, Dr. Humes then asked that the x-rays showing the large skull hole be put up on the screen for Dr. Angel's benefit. Now, the doctor suggested that the Harper fragment be moved toward the extreme forward part of the parietal bone where the coronal suture marks the border with the frontal bone. Could that be corona suture? Asked Dr. Petty. Replied Angel, I would have guessed that it might be. Again, I don't see any meningeal vessel markings, but that's conceivable. Dr. Angel now apparently realized that the x-rays showed that the hole actually extended into the frontal bone. Now there was damage that far forward, and he saw it as he was viewing the lateral x-ray. He commented, yes, that's right. That was his immediate reaction. Well, this then could be frontal perfectly well. It does show the meningeal markings, and that's what made me unhappy about it to begin with. Well, the photo makes more sense now. Okay, by this point, Dr. Angel had considered two distinct locations for the Harper fragment. After some discussion, Angel now came up with a third place for the Harper fragment, somewhere on the top of the head in the parietal area. And that's when Dr. Petty asked whether the Harper piece could be fitted posterior and slightly lateral. Is that what you're saying? He replied, this is what I'm saying, yes. And Angel replied, that is what I'm saying, yes. And perhaps a bit later he commented, it's hard to do that jigsaw puzzle. And that's all I can say. Dr. Petty admitted, well, it's terribly fragmented and we really can't reconstruct it. Indeed, Dr. Petty seemed willing at this point to settle for less. He would say, our ultimate question is, do you think this would well be part of the skull of the late president's head? Referring now to the Harper piece, of course. Angel replied, yes. The record indicated then that the Harper fragment was moved around on the head by Dr. Angel and members of the panel trying to find a place for it within the hole that Dr. Angel indicated, so it might show lambdoid suture, sagittal suture, and corona suture corresponding roughly to the right rear, the middle at the top, and then the forward part of the head. Take your pick. A month later, on October 24, 1977, Dr. Angel submitted his report. In it, he described the perimeter of the whole scene on the photographs in order to approximate the position of the fragment. He wrote, it's necessary to do this to define the gap, a sentence making the jigsaw method explicit, and then he drew three more sketches labeling the top view, deduced, not observed, from the Harper fragment photographs. He wrote that this photograph shows it as coming mainly from the upper middle third of the right parietal bone. Dr. Angel's report is noteworthy for the lack of any specific anthropological evidence uniquely identifying the bone. His memo states vascular foramina on the inside and a faint irregular line on the outside indicative of sagittal suture. But the transcript a month earlier shows he said, at first I could see marks of sagittal suture here, but I don't think that's it. Concluding his report, Dr. Angel attempted to relate the borders of the Harper fragment to the borders of the wound, the margin shown in the autopsy pictures, borders which Dr. Hume said showed no relationship at all, using language such as, one section appears to fit another, it can fit, and in a third reference in Dr. Angel's report, he said, may meet. This leaves the following question for history to decide. Whose identification of the Harper fragment is more reliable? That of A.B. Cairns, who actually held the bone in his hand and examined it and said it was occipital bone, an opinion concurred to by the two other doctors who also saw the bone in person? Or the memorandum of Dr. Angel. Ever since A.B. Cairns uttered that original conclusion, that is, in his opinion, the bone specimen looked like it came from the occipital region of the skull, well, conspiracy books ever since have quoted Cairns and used his assessment as evidence of a frontal shot exiting the rear of the head. Author Josiah Thompson in 6 Seconds in Dallas, after citing Cairns, notes that it is difficult to understand how a shot from the rear could drive a piece of the occipital bone 25 feet to the left of the vehicle's path. It is not so difficult to understand how a shot from the right front exploding through the rear of the skull could produce precisely that effect. But again, suppose Cairns was wrong here. The Warren Commission failed to deal with this issue at all. However, by 1977, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations began its work, the existence of the bone and its possible importance were well known. The committee's forensic pathology panel studied photos of the fragment made at Methodist Hospital, and you can see it included as Warren Commission Document 1395. The committee attempted reconstruction of the skull fractures using paper cutouts that were prepared to approximate the shape and the size of the bone fragments, demonstrated in X-rays numbers 4, 5, and 6, and a photograph of the Harper bone fragment. The panel attempted to locate the correct position of these fragments and then, using the paper cutouts, to place these bone fragments on a human skull for the purposes of reconstruction. All of this was done before the conversation they had with Dr. Angel. The largest of the X-ray fragments, which showed outer beveling and tiny metal fragments, are evident according to that reconstruction. According to that reconstruction, it completes a portion of the exit perforation within the suture line fitting into the coronal suture. The Harper bone fragment completes the circular perforation in the suture line immediately superior to the temporal bone. No other exit or entrance perforation is identified. That was the committee's position on this. What was the committee's rationale when they documented this in their final report? Well, it went something like this. Immediately superior to the temporal bone is parietal bone. not occipital bone. Further, since the autopsy photos and x-rays showed occipital bone intact, although replete with fractures, at the time of the Bethesda autopsy, it was obvious that the Harper fragment could not be occipital bone. Well, there you have it. They again went back and blessed the authenticity of the x-rays, and then because the x-rays had to be authentic and there was no gap in the occipital area, this could not possibly be occipital bone. They're probably right, if the x-rays are authentic. Again, this whole review and exchange had to be conducted based on photographs of the Harper fragment because the original had never been retrieved after going into the black hole of the FBI. And on the topic of the missing piece of evidence itself, HSCA staff investigator Andrew Purdy wrote a memo to the file related to the Harper fragment. It's buried in Appendix 10 of the House Select Committee's final report. It's worth reading here for you, and so I'll quote it now. It's a memorandum to the file from Andrew Purdy dated August 17, 1977, with the subject being the search for the missing autopsy materials. I spoke with Dr. Jack Harper on August 8th by phone. Dr. Harper is the uncle of the pre-medical student who found the fragment in Dealey Plaza. Dr. Harper presumes the skull fragment is now with the other skull fragments and said that his nephew gave it to the FBI. Dr. Harper saw the fragment on the Sunday following the assassination and took it to the Methodist Hospital on Monday, at which time he contacted the FBI. Dr. Harper said the consensus of the doctors who reviewed the skull fragment was that it was part of the occipital region. Dr. Harper said he retained a photo of the skull fragment for about a year, at which time the FBI took it from him. He says that he believes his nephew still has such a photograph. Dr. Harper said the skull fragment had relatively fresh blood on it. I spoke with Dr. A.B. Cairns on August 9, 1977, regarding the Harper skull fragment. Dr. Cairns has retired from his position as chief of pathology at Methodist Hospital. I spoke with Dr. Cairns once by telephone regarding his recollections of examining the skull fragment. Dr. Cairns said that the piece of skull fragment came from an area approximately 2.5 to 3 inches above the spine area. He said it had the markings of a piece of skull fragment from the lower occipital area, specifically containing suture and inner markings where blood vessels run around the base of the skull. Dr. Cairns remembered a small area of the skull fragment showing grayish discoloration, suggesting metallic stain on the bone. He said he had had experience with gunshot damage in the past, which looked similar to this discoloration. Dr. Cairns said he could see blood markings which indicated the skull fragment had been dislodged recently. Dr. Cairns stated that he wasn't very interested in the skull fragment, but did believe it was part of the assassination. Dr. Cairns said that the skull fragment had no indication of being an entry or an exit wound. He said, in other words, that the edges of the wound did not show. However, he said he believed the skull fragment came from an area close to the entry wound by virtue of the way the tables were broken. Dr. Cairns said that he was interviewed by an FBI agent from Oklahoma City with a Spanish surname. This memo ends here with seemingly no additional explanation of the FBI interview, the one that took place with the FBI agent who had a Spanish surname. It does seem like an odd place to end the memo. But nevertheless, even what is in this FBI memo is telling. There were other skilled researchers and medical professionals with other views of this. We can't go into all of them, but let's address one of them here. Dr. Joseph Riley was a neuroanatomist and conspiracy-oriented researcher, and he's done extensive research and examination of this issue. On the basis of several distinctive and identifying features, he judges the Harper fragment to be parietal bone. These features include, 1, a pattern of vascular grooving consistent with parietal bone and inconsistent with occipital bone. 2, a lack of a deep sulci, the grooves found in occipital bone. 3, a smooth inner surface, mild curvature, and relatively uniform thickness. 3. Parietal foramina, that is, vascular perforations of a type that occur only in parietal bone, and that's visible in the photographs of the Harper fragment. Joe Riley believes that, in spite of the initial judgment by A.B. Cairns, the clear weight of the medical expertise sides with the Harper fragment being parietal bone, and its placement not from the back, but rather at the top and the side of the head. And then there is Dr. David Mantic. David Mantic argues just the opposite. In Murder in Dealey Plaza, he states that the Harper fragment is mostly occipital bone, that autopsy photo number 44, otherwise known as F8, shows the outer rear of JFK's skull, and the Harper fragment fits neatly into a vacancy in the rear skull seen in that photograph. David Mantic received his doctorate in physics from the University of Wisconsin, and he was a member of the physics faculty at the university before leaving for medical school. He completed his internship and residency in radiation oncology at the USC Medical Center in LA. He also completed fellowships in physics at the University of Illinois and in biophysics at Stanford University. Mantic has carried out extensive research into the assassination of JFK. This includes detailed studies of Kennedy's autopsy x-rays and the Zapruder film. In 1993, Mantic disclosed that after examining the autopsy x-rays at the National Archives, they had been altered and that there were at least two shots which struck the president's head, and that the magic bullet theory is anatomically impossible. Mantic, along with Robert Livingston, Charles Crenshaw, Ronald White, Jack White, they all contributed to a book called Assassination Science, which you've heard me refer to before. It's a book that was also edited by James Fetzer. Mantic also contributed to a number of other important studies on this topic. Whether you aspire to believe one of these theories or another, these are all, by definition, highly intelligent, highly intellectual individuals who have a basis for studying these materials and coming to some form of conclusion, if one can be made. In the end, it's a simple question without a simple answer. Who are you going to believe? And what are you going to believe? That is really the question. The Harper fragment is gone, missing. Another one of those mysteries inside the JFK assassination story, and one of the circumstances where the facts in the case are stranger than fiction. Any positive identification of the fragment as being from the occipital region would surely put to rest all the controversy. The simple controversy over whether there was a hole in the back of the president's head. But if that is true, if this was occipital bone, it opens up a Pandora's box of all kinds of things. Were photos faked? Were x-rays faked? Were reports faked? Wasn't there a shot from the front, and thus two shooters? No doubt, the trail of concerns accumulates to an avalanche of bad news for the Warren Commission and even the HSCA conclusions about many things, including the idea, ultimately, of a conspiracy in the shooting, as well as a conspiracy in the cover-up, which occurred in the aftermath. Maybe two different events, but certainly raising the idea that both were conspiratorial in nature and quite possibly happened, based on what this one piece of evidence might be telling us in a total vacuum. That's why the Harper fragment has celebrity status in the world of evidence related to the JFK assassination. Don't you wish you could hear directly from Dr. Berkeley himself? He seems to hold the key to the whereabouts of the fragment. Well, maybe. Or someone at the FBI. Would Dr. Berkeley know something more, though? Perhaps have been motivated to keep any piece of evidence out of the public eye that suggested more than the government's lone gunman story used to create the initial narrative after the assassination? We'll take a closer look at this very topic in the very next episode. One more fact in the case that is stranger than fiction.
So, and my position is no, there's no single bullet theory, no matter how simple you want to keep it. Second item you see is the anterior brain. On the x-rays, which you saw, especially the lateral x-ray, which we can visit again if you like, there's a very dark area in front of the brain. It's almost fist-sized. and it has just about as much brain in it as the frontal sinus does, according to the optical density measurements. So no frontal brain on either left or right, but you just saw the brain photographs, didn't you? Or if you didn't, Robert Grodin has copies of them here, and they show nearly intact brain on both left and right. How do we reconcile that? In my opinion, one of those must be inauthentic. Either the x-rays are telling us a lie or the photograph of the brain is telling us a lie. I can't reconcile those. I've never found anyone who could.
Thank you for listening to episode 89 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.